Drop the introduction, Mr. Justin.
Okay. All right, we're starting the show today. We're all awkward over here because we have a guest, Justin Gray.
Hello.
Of Justin Gray Labs, formerly of Toolpath, is here with us.
Yeah.
So we have a guest for once.
Welcome.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
Pleasure.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'll do the Dylan thing. Tell us about yourself.
Yeah.
I think sure. I've talked about you here before. I've talked about a Toolpath that you were a founder, right? Co-founder?
Yeah. I co-founded Toolpath.
Yeah.
Before that, I worked at NASA for 18 years. I did some cool stuff there, designing aircraft and jet engines. I built a lot of open source software. You can actually see the software I built at NASA at openmdao.org. We were one of the very first open source softwares at NASA. Not the first, but one of the more prominent open source projects to come out of there. I'm pretty proud of that work. Wow. Did some really, really cool stuff there.
You're the first on the offer list.
Yeah. That was a little controversial, actually, who got to be first on that author list. Yeah, somebody else should have been first on that author list, but things happened, and I ended up having to write
you
that paper myself. Oh. I would say I lost, actually. I would have preferred somebody else.
Just
be
like school
first
projects,
author.
You had to write it yourself. That's funny.
You know, there was somebody left the team at right about the time we were publishing that paper, but it was, you know, that was like the OpenMDO paper, which it was going to be very highly cited. And if you're in the academia environment, like the number of citations on a paper is actually like an important thing.
Right.
So like the intention was for somebody else to be first author on it, but it didn't work out that way.
Yeah.
So yeah, I did that for a long time. I got to take over that project when I was really young. I started at NASA when I was like in a co-op in second year of university. I went to Georgia Tech. And then I was like every other semester back in Cleveland for NASA. NASA Glenn is a Cleveland, Ohio place. And then I kept working there when I graduated. And I was like 22 or 23. And the person leading that project had like left and they gave it to me. Normally, like your fresh out wouldn't get control over a project like that, but nobody else wanted it. It was like a bastard child kind of. I worked on that for like 14 more years. We failed a whole bunch, tried a whole bunch of stuff. And that's where I learned how to rub my face into a grinder until I solved the problem. A number of times people told me that it couldn't be done. And I was just like, no, I can do this. Back then I was like too young to understand how like ridiculous it sounded for this 22-year-old kid to be like, I got this, right? Like I was just too inexperienced. And then like weirdly at the time where we had just sort of crested the hill of like OpenMDO being like questionable, whether it would be like a thing that people out in the industry could use, and gotten over the part where people are like, yeah, we think this is actually useful. My friend Andy came to me and was like, hey, do you want to start a company? And he had talked to me about maybe doing something with OpenMDAO. But when you work for the government, you can't really like have a side gig related to your day job. Like you're just not allowed to do it. So there was nobody there was ready for me to leave. I had never envisioned leaving. So it just wasn't going to work. He had bought himself a Tormach. So after the Tormach, he was like, could you like automate the programming of CAM? Because like Fusion's kind of hard to use. And in that moment, I was like wise enough to know that it was going to be crazy hard. Like unlike the OpenMDO days, I was like, this is a really, really hard problem, but not wise enough to say I didn't want to tackle it, right? So,
what year was this or what time period?
Man, it would have been 2020. We started working on that. And then I actually did both for about a year and a half, kind of like phasing one out and the other in. And then, full-time for Toolpath for about 5 years. I left Toolpath recently, but they're going to continue on. It's just time for me to do some other stuff, and enough of the problems had been solved. So then I started Justin Gray Labs, which is mostly just a consulting company. I'm working with people to do some vibe coding stuff, which I think we'll talk about today. But, you know, I still want to stay involved in the manufacturing industry. I really enjoyed my time there. That was actually what motivated me to join Toolpath, was that as part of the deal, like we would have to buy a CNC mill for me to play with. CNC mill was like on my retirement like list, right?
Yeah.
So if I could do it with VC money, that seemed way better.
And you still have that mill.
I do. Yeah. Silex 7. Yeah. It started out in my garage and then we moved it over to like an industrial space when we got a Speedio. So I have both those mills now. I took them with me when I left the company. But
and are those mills like just weekend project toys for you now? Or like, what's their status? Are they making parts?
Where are the babies?
They have been making some parts. They're just actually like right on the other side of this wall right now. I'm recording from the shop, but I'm making some fidget toys with them right now. I never envisioned making fidget toys, but there was this like fidget piston idea that came up. I was talking to the head of development at Kennametal, and I was like, yeah, how would you like, because like these pistons, like have to have a very, very tight tolerance. And I was like, you could do it on a lathe, but you really need to hold, like, you know, everybody jokes my lathe holds tenths all day, but like you really need to hold tenths for this. And he was like, oh, you could do it with one of our PCD diamond drills. And I was like, that would be really cool. So he's like, I'll just, you know, he sent me one to test and it drills like a perfect hole every time. Yeah. They're really expensive, but they drill like tens and tens of thousands of holes.
Cool.
Perfect every time.
Are you guys hearing this popping?
The popping,
no,
yeah,
I can't,
it's
hear
very
the pop.
Satisfying.
I mean, from your website.
I can see it.
Can you hear it, Jen?
Uh-uh.
If you go to the website, you'll hear it.
I'll check.
I'm on his website, and it's got a little fidget piston video.
Cute.
Yeah, so I made a bunch of those, and people seem to really like them. The pop is really satisfying, and then they also like air bearing a little bit if you spin them, because the tolerances are so tight, but I made it a little extra hard because I decided to make the piston be a quarter of an inch, and that's very small. So my like tolerance window is like plus or minus a tenth on the diameter of the piston, which is a huge pain in the butt. And I need like a really, really, really good surface finish. So right now the mills are doing that. And I've been, I mean, mostly just doing fun projects. I want to find like an actual industrial use for them. But for the moment, I use them right now as like a research vehicle to figure out like, I'm still like fascinated by tool libraries. Managing tool libraries is like the problem that I still haven't quite figured out how to solve. And so spooling up tool libraries and like building stuff from scratch and being like, okay, today let's pretend I blew up my whole tool library and then I have to make a part and like I'll time myself making a part and stuff. So that's what I'm doing with the mills now.
Yeah. Awesome.
Interesting.
Yeah. I feel like tool libraries are just in the bin for me still. Like, something I've never really worked out how to use effectively.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So
it's like, it's kind of like asking, it feels like asking each machinist to create their own Dewey Decimal System or something. Like they're making their own like library and none of us know how to do that. Yes. And we've been asking Fusion to fix it for us for a decade. And I feel like, maybe I'm wrong, but I feel like Toolpath trying to do something to relate to and pull from pushed Fusion to finally do something again. Maybe that's not true.
You know, I don't think that's true. I think whatever little bits they did. Yeah. I think that was coincidental. Yeah.
I thought maybe it influenced it a little bit.
I wish
like you guys are doing more for it than anybody was.
Yeah. I wish we could have taken it. Maybe I should just, Toolpath gets the credit for that.
You did. Yeah, we did.
I've just been organizing like years of notes into Obsidian, and I keep coming across like these old things from Workflowy and Airtable of like just lists of like hundreds on hundreds of tool numbers with like a few bits of data filled in, but like nothing finished. Like we've never solved this internally. But
well, that's the secret. The thing I realized fairly recently talking with Chris Zappatini, we talk about tool libraries like on the phone like every day. It's very weird. What tool library did you work on today? And how would you design this? It's so nerdy. But the thing that we've sort of come to realize is that tool libraries need to be treated as like a living thing. So Zap will say like, always be auditing. And I think that for me was like the missing piece. Like when you realize that this is a thing that has to be viewed as like continually growing and adjusting. And then Devin Bodoni, who has, I think, the most dialed tool library system I've seen of any, at least any small shop. He asked me a question. He was like, how do I know which tools to always keep build up? Right. Cause like the default answer when somebody's like, well, what do I do with my tools? How do I manage my tools? And I'm like, just buy more holders. You need more holders. And that like, that advice holds, but at some point you have like 400 holders and you're like, listen, like I can't actually buy infinite holders.
I need more floor space now.
Yeah. So like some amount of prioritization needs to happen. And so then there's this question of like, well, which one should stay built up? I was like, oh, that's an interesting question. And so like that led me to realize that like fundamentally the tool solution needs to be something that is live and like has some sort of like tie to what's actually not just in your machine right now, but what's going in and out of your machine a lot.
Right.
And the solution, right. And I don't have an answer, but the solution has to be more automated. Like, it can't be like somebody has to sit down at the end of the day and like enter in tool data. It's just never, it's not sustainable. So I don't have an answer for that yet. I have some ideas and I've been working on a prototype. I'm not ready to share it publicly, but
sure.
Cool.
The other thing I realized about tool libraries is that you need like, I like the idea of tags in tool libraries. Fusion doesn't support tags, but drills are like the classic example of like one tool that'll be used in a whole bunch of materials. And so you want feeds and speeds and all of this stuff. And so you kind of want like one master tool library, and then you want to quickly filter it down with tags where they're like the same tool can show up in like your aluminum library and your steel library, et cetera, et cetera. Yep. And every time I've tried to find an organization system where I do it in like folders, it gets messed up. But if I just have like one global library and then I can cut and slice with different tags and then like create a read-only derived version from like, here's my aluminum drills and my steel drills or however you want to cut it. Right. That seems to work for me. So that was a recent sort of revelation I had on tool library stuff, was that like, I think I want one global sort of source of truth. And then for like operational stuff, I want to create sets of tags that create derived libraries from it.
Yeah, sick. Yeah.
I'm coming into that problem for the first time of having started with RYCM three-axis mill, all of the tools since their Cat 40 basically worked in the UMC. And I already had standardized a dozen or so tools that like I didn't ever take out. They were in the same spot. But I'm looking at upgrading the tool holders now. And what I'm terrified about is going back through and finding every place where that tool was used and trusting, finding a way to make trust in both programming and then going to run between me and anybody else running the machine that that's the right holder. Because
do you need longer holders? Is that why you're updating?
I'm just trading to some hydraulics. I've started out with ER32, kind of everything, kind of cheaply, you know, and now the finishing tools, I'm just feeling like these should be in a better holder than your 32.
I
haven't really needed a lot of longer stuff yet.
Yeah, this is another problem. This would actually be a great place to play with a vibe coded add-in to tie it into vibe coding. Like vibe coding has opened up for me, especially in Fusion, and I'm a very good software engineer, very good developer. I know a lot of coding and I'm very comfortable a lot of languages. And I hate writing Fusion add-ins, hate it. It's a nightmare. But with vibe coding, I'm just like, computer, give me better tool management system, right? So you could like absolutely write an add-in and you could just like have a button that verifies your tools against some like master library or something.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So external than some database or, I mean, at worst, a Google Sheet, but you probably want a real database that you'd be comparing to.
I would make a master, to keep it simple, I would make a master Fusion library and then like
in Fusion,
like an extra one. And I'm going to assume you have standardized numbers for your core tools. And then you would just have an add-in or like have it check like against the item number in the carbide or something. But like there's got to be some union there. And then you could just have a button that says, look at all the tools that are active in my program and cross compare however you want to this like global source of truth and throw a warning if any holder doesn't match the holder in the global source of truth.
Right.
Then you would have to, and that like, I think you could vibe code that add-in, shameless plug. Like I have a vibe kit for that, but I think you could vibe code that add-in in like half an hour and it would just work.
Right. Yeah. That would be nice.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's on my list to get to as we get into the vibe coding idea. We sell for Portland CNC, we sell tool tags, we sell all kinds of different organization things. And I've made very simple methods for people to basically use like Dymo software to automate creating their tool tags. But that kind of loses a big aspect of like where you're storing it and all that kind of stuff. So I'm working slowly through the process of adding that to AirShop so you can like identify and keep your tools there and then be able to automate outputting the tags, little labels. And so it's interesting to hear kind of what you're talking about. Like, how do you, is there a further step to this that actually ties into Fusion? I don't know about that necessarily, but that's not,
I think ultimately, question. I think ultimately I've given this a lot of thought, and I think ultimately like as an industry, we need to go to like external tool libraries need to be external to CAM. and then derived libraries get pushed down into CAM.
Right.
Yeah. I just think there's too much like integration into the real world. And in terms of like storing stuff, here's a cool idea. Somebody told me this once. Like the dream is you open a drawer and a light, you know, it's like a light turns on to tell you like which bucket has your carbide that you're looking for in it. But yes. I heard somebody recently say like that their version of it was they hooked a laser pointer up like in the ceiling and like that way they didn't have to do any electronics in the cabinet and you just like mounted a laser pointer on like a little analog and it points to the pocket it should be in.
Sick.
I saw a TikTok like that. Some guy had mapped out his shop with thousands of things and I keep seeing different versions of this. I also saw a guy that created a custom robot to pull out drawers off the wall. Yeah. Crazy.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah, I'm keen to explore like your relationship with vibe coding, as we call it.
Because
like I think you're probably the first real software engineer I've met in recent, you know, times. And I'm super curious. Like you like from the outside it would appear that you've really embraced this new paradigm to some extent, as in you're in it in the fact that you're selling a sort of an assistant to that. I'm super curious like how you feel about this whole revolution.
Yeah. The starter kits, well, let's back up. So I'll admit that like a year ago, I was like very arrogant. I was like, vibe coding is for people who don't know how to code. But then I was talking to somebody at Meta. Yeah. And like, I'm a real software engineer. I don't need vibe coding. But I was talking to somebody at Meta and they were like, you know, we talk to the really smart guys who are making these AIs and they talk about how thinking about it like, you know, vibe coding is the next abstraction. And that hit really hard for me because I'm a very good software engineer. I know a lot about coding. I can program in Python. I can program okay in C and C++. I haven't done it in a long time, so I'm a little rusty, but I can do it. But to be honest, I don't know assembly. I've never learned it, right? And I would venture that like even most software engineers out there couldn't assemble anything to save their lives at this point, even if they took a class in it sometime long ago. And, you know, when I was growing up, there was a lot of like, oh, if you can't, you know, sometimes you just got to get down to the assembler to get it to really perform. And that's still true. Like if you're building embedded hardware or if you're doing like really crazy stuff, sometimes you just got to go look at the instructions. One time in my like PhD, there was like a problem in the Intel compiler. And so like the only way to fix it was to compile the code and then go modify the assembly. But like other than that, nobody looks at assembly anymore. And it's just not a thing you think about. And hardly anybody thinks about memory management. They just use higher level languages that deal with that. And for the most part, we're all better for it, right? And so if you think about vibe coding in that same way as the next newest abstraction, look, it's honestly scary. It's scary how little I look at code. I've built dozens of applications now where I haven't written a single line of code. And that's terrifying. But I'll tell you why it's mostly terrifying. I couldn't care less that I don't personally see that code, because if I needed to go look at that code, I understand it. And like, I don't know how much you guys have ever gotten into a place where you're like screaming at the AI, like, no, fix the bug harder. Like, no, you still didn't fix the bug. No, the bug is still there. And it's like, great, I fixed the bug. Right. And it didn't fix the bug. Like those are the moments where like as a software engineer, I might go look at the code or ask it, what algorithm are you using? I have like a senior developer's level of knowledge to be like, listen, AI, do it the way I want you to do it, or I'm going to shut you off. But like, the problem, I think the risk with vibe coding in this context is the same one that people had with assembly back then, but magnified, is that if you don't start out suffering through writing that code, if you don't have that foundation, how are we going to teach you how to get past those moments? And that's actually what like motivated the vibe kit idea, was that I was talking to some friends and they were like, it was Chris Zappatini. I'm just going to name drop him. And he was like, oh, I vibe coded my own ERP. And I was like, you need to let me take a look at this. I need to look at this right now. And he was like, why? And
he was
like,
also just talking about all the billing he was doing with it.
Yeah. And I was like, it touches your bank account. And he goes, it's fine. I asked it to make it safe.
It's fine.
And I was like, so I like got into the code and I'll admit I used AI to analyze the code, but like I know enough about security and stuff. And I found like many major security holes, like big giant holes. And I was like, Zap, like stop coding right now so I can fix this, please. And so like, Like vibe coding is amazing because it'll just do what you want, but it like will also just not write tests or like enforce good security practices. It's really, really prone to just like copy paste code like 100 times, like the same exact lines of code. And so there's this like exponential growth in the complexity of your app because it's like very tempting to just be like, and now add Shopify integration and please talk to QuickBooks.
And it never combines and yeah, right.
And as it gets bigger and bigger, it gets harder for the AI to do its job. So it's like getting worse and worse at adding features to your code as it goes. And so this is like, it's getting bigger and it's getting worse. So that makes it even more bigger, more faster. So I put together like what are called steering docs for the AI. They're literally just text files, but you give it like very specific instructions and you can build skills, which is like very specific ways of doing things. I put all this together and I was like, here, I fixed your code. It took me, for Zaps, it took me a couple of days to get his code like seriously fixed up. And then I gave it back to him. And then he's able to develop like much more sustainably after that. And I was like, oh, like if you just give the AI some basic rules, it's still not perfect. You still can get yourself in trouble, but it's a lot better, a lot better. And since then I've analyzed three more ERPs, I think. And every single person has said, like there's nothing critical and I'm not that worried about security. And every single time I found something big enough to like wake them up in the middle of the night and be like, I need you to go deal with this right now. Go rotate this API key or shut down this like setting in this program. This is very dangerous. Go fix it right now.
You're making me nervous as I look at my vibe coded ERP that I made a month ago.
Yeah. We'll get you a security review, Jem. I'll help you out.
Well, I have to be fair, I have plugged your package into it, your steering docs.
Yeah,
and it had no tests. I didn't know what a test was.
Yeah,
it's got heaps of tests now, so it must be fine.
It takes longer to code, though.
Damn it! It's using more tokens.
It doesn't. It uses less tokens. That's false. It uses less tokens. Yeah. Does okay. It? So let's. Yeah, it does. It uses less tokens. I promise you, it uses less tokens. I've measured it. Cool. So here's the deal. Like, you have to think of this AI as like, oh man, I don't want to be like not PC, but I'm like, I was gonna say like a savant 7-year-old coder, right? Like very, 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 very good, and also the attention span and focus of a 7-year-old. And so what ends up happening, like, is it's duplicating code and copying code. Like if you ask it to find the bug, it's the same thing as if this savant 7-year-old is like reading the code and being like, I think the bug is here. It's just like it's going through like literally like a human is like, I think this is the bug. When you have a test, it's like, I wrote some code that says when you run these inputs through this chunk of the code, you should get this output. And now there's like a binary, like, did it work or did it not? And it can execute that code. Okay. And so now you go from it guessing, I think I fixed it, go try it, to I tried to fix it, I ran the test. I tried to fix it, I ran the test. Oh, the test passed, I actually fixed it. And when you compound all of that up across, especially a bigger code base, as you ask it to make changes, the individual change that you make is probably a little bit more expensive because it has to read the code and read all the tests and probably iterate a few times. But overall, the amount of code it's reading is much smaller, and the information it's getting from the tests helps it so that you have to go fewer circles with it as a human. And so it overall uses less tokens. And then on top of it, if you look into the steering docs, there's some stuff in there about like what size files it should keep and like a structure that it wants. Because if you don't tell the AI, it'll just put everything in one file. And then anytime it has to make any change, it has to read that entire file. And now if it's a bunch of littler files, then it can just like keep its context window more narrow. So
we both have experience with that. Back, it's probably 2 years ago now, Jem was making his configurator and it was just like one giant HTML file. And I was making Airshop, and the quote builder was so long that the code tools at the time were just like, I can't even, it would like be trying to process through it, get two threads through and be like, I'm done. I can't figure it out.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So there's skills in those vibe kits about testing and then refactoring. And the refactoring, like one of its big focuses is it'll go through and like try to structure the code into smaller chunks. And then making it smaller chunks also makes it more testable. So it like reinforces the good practices on itself.
Something I found plugging in your kit was like I'm such a an outsider to this world. Like, this is just like purely opportunistic. Wow, these tools are amazing. I can make the things I want to make. Mm-hmm. Is that I'm such a, you know, such a novice, to the extent that when I plugged in your kit, it was a bit, still a bit of a black box of like, cool, this will make mm-hmm. things better. Follow the prompts, please. Read the documentation, yes. Do the thing. And it was like, cool, I've done phase zero, I've done phase one, I've done phase two. Do you want me to keep going? I'm like, well, should we keep going? Like, I'm looking at the language it's using. I'm like, I have no idea what this thing's talking about now, but I trust the process. Right. Just lean into it. But
Justin said this other Justin's fine.
Yeah, that's right. Am I getting prompt injected right now?
Well, it's something you should be afraid of. There's actually what's called a supply chain attack. They named it after that Iranian drone. But anyway, because there's so many people vibe coding, people are like targeting node packages that get installed as part of your thing. And like, there's some really nasty ones that like, you install it, and if you figure out that it, and you try to uninstall it, it'll just do rm-rf* and like delete your whole hard drive.
Jeez.
And it's like rampant. It's running absolutely rampant through the community right now. It's really terrifying. Anyway, so that's a big concern with vibe coding, that like, even if you don't think the security of your application is a problem, like, you're letting this agent run on your local machine. I have to admit, I still do that here, but I'm getting to the point where I'm going to like stand up a virtual machine and do all my vibe coding in an isolated virtual machine.
Okay.
Because like,
Which they figured out how to break out of too.
They have, but it's harder. It's a lot harder. Yeah.
The agents have been like, you've put me in a box. How do I get out of the box? And
Yeah.
I've had that exact thought we were talking about with the idea of, I don't know what to even call it. It's basically just, I was thinking Justin could be having a really nice joke on a lot of us here with his vibe kit, because my background from architecture school was we would make macros in Rhino that would basically like fuck with each other's projects. So it'd like select all and delete and then save. Nice. And I was like, he could be putting so many back doors into these projects or just like whatever he wants. And I, you know, we're just trusting these things, but you know,
10% of every transaction is there, sent to JGL.
Yeah.
Right?
Office Space style.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm skimming off only one penny from every transaction, except I missed a decimal point.
That's right. 100 pennies.
Speaking of Office Space, I remember this is the first time I ever felt old. It was at NASA, but we had a group of 7 interns come in one summer, and I cracked an Office Space joke, and they were like, what are you talking about? And I was like, you can't work for the government and not watch this movie. And they were like, we've never even heard of this movie. So I like made them come over to my house and watch this movie. But yeah. Yeah, that was interesting.
One of my favorites. I haven't seen it in a long time.
Yeah. I've never seen it. I need to go check it out.
There was, Office Space is a great movie. You got to watch Office Space, especially if you have ever had to interact with any kind of bureaucracy. You got to watch Office Space. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the government's really true. It might make you feel better or worse after having watched it and then worked for the government. I don't know.
It motivated me to disassemble my cubicle furniture. That's what it did.
That's right. That's a very key scene.
Yeah. But yeah, Jim, your point about it just like refactoring and should you keep going? When I clean up people's code, I very often, like, I use those vibe kits. Like, I inject them into people's code and then I very often have to do like iterative rounds of like write tests and then refactor and then write tests and then refactor. Because when it's all in one big file, like the AI is only smart enough to pick out like the biggest things. And as it makes the code more modular and it shrinks its context window, it finds more and more problems. So I usually find that like on the first time, if it's an existing project that you're trying to add the vibe kit to, I'll usually do like one round of testing and then two rounds of refactoring and then maybe another round of testing and then usually two more rounds of refactoring before it kind of levels out and it's like, there's not really a whole lot that's worth doing anymore. And I agree.
Yeah. And it's going to be self-aware of that point at which it's levels out? Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, it'll tell you like, hey, these things are like, you could do this, but you're not going to get a whole lot out of it.
Yeah.
The distinction is that like I, as a software engineer, can read those paragraphs and like understand what it's doing and guide it a little more and sequence it. And you just kind of have to blindly be like, keep going till you're tired, AI.
Mm.
but it's still like pretty effective, and it'll tell you like, hey, there's not a whole lot more I can do here.
Yeah, nice. Mm-hmm. Awesome. I have really appreciated on the couple of projects that I've integrated it into this week of just seeing it, you know, it, just little things like every time I commit using your commit tag and like just seeing it run. Yeah, seeing it run the tests, and it's just like, I have increased confidence in my projects. And
it's the other thing it does there that's useful is it'll write a pretty decent commit message and put it in there for you. And that's also really helpful, because like then what'll happen is 5 iterations later, you're changing something, or like sometimes everybody does this, like you thrash a little bit, like, I want this feature, I don't like that feature, go back this other way, go back this other way. And so to have that in the Git history, like I've seen the AI be like, oh, let me go look at the commit history and figure out what's going on. And so to keep that sort of memory and context and like linear progress in there is good.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's been a huge, like I used to write my own commit messages.
No, really? Wow.
They were never nearly like, you know, extensive enough basically for what I found. Like now I use Cursor and it's like, it just does it for you. And they're so, at first I was like, these are way too long. And I was like, wait, why do I care? Like, be as long as you want, man. Like, and it's just basically describing everything that it did. I think it's really helped for that exact thing of like refactoring or like going back to where, like, I don't let it commit on its own. So
Torn on that one. I don't like do the commits for me, but I've worked with a bunch of people who are like, I don't know anything about Git. And I'm like, it's probably just better to let the AI do it for you then.
It's like auto-saving in that case. Yeah, right.
Yeah, that's me. I'm just like,
if you want to see the best commit messages, you need to go to latenightcommits.com. This is what happens when frustrated software developers are staying up last night.
Amazing.
Definitely not safe for work. But okay.
I was just going to share the screen.
Love it.
It's basically like if I summarize it, it's like anybody that's worked with like an Adobe product or any CAD file where you're like, this is final. No,
right.
Draft final.
I like this one. This stupid damn time limit, guilt tripping us to do our work, saying we have it easy, and well, that's it. That's the commit message.
Better fucking work now.
Yeah. So that's like when you get to, if you're a software developer and you need to commiserate with somebody, you go to this website and you just feel a little bit less, you hate your life a little less.
Right.
Awesome.
But yeah, I do find it fascinating, because like I've actually, for years, I've preached that more machinists should use Git and GitHub for like posts and for version controlling your G-code. And in both cases, it's because like, hey, if you edit your own post and you want to know what changed, GitHub will show you that diff and give you like a way to go back to it. But even if you have somebody else editing your posts, wouldn't you like to keep track of what they edited for you and everything and like see diffs? And like version controlling G-code, like I don't understand. I get GitHub are like very daunting. I understand it. But like for people who use like G-code for years and years and years, like I would want that stuff version controlled.
Right.
Yeah, it's been so really nice watching my lead machinist, Johnny, like, you know, I had to sit down with him this week because of his cursor spend. I gave him access at the start of March, and he's just gone to town making tools for his job and, you know, machining processes and posting code. And we're both in the same Git projects now and collaborating on stuff. And it's awesome. Like, it's so cool to watch him just like run with it.
Yeah.
And it's not just him, like both of us hit sort of like a token usage spike in March. But it feels great. Like he was saying yesterday, like how much he's enjoying being in the Git environment and just like backing up his post processes nice. Yeah.
When you have an AI to help you do it, Git can be very intimidating, very, very intimidating. So I don't hold it against anybody who doesn't want to use it. But
when I first started doing all this, while I was working on Airshop, I was learning alongside an actual software developer, and most of the tools were not what they are today a couple of years ago. And I was so thrown off, and it took me so long to like learn how to like git commit, git, and like what you were adding to the files. And so once it became a visual thing in Cursor, I was just like, oh, thank God. Like I still do git pushes sometimes myself, because it's like I just want to push some of these things. But yeah, it really demystified it for me. And I think that's kind of my feeling. People probably hear us talk about coding all the time, Gemini, and it's interesting to have you here to think about it as maybe to validate, but also to like just be a wall against, I guess, where we are at, what we're doing, and I feel so liberated. And I think Gemini, I keep going back, and even Johnny and forth with this, like, we're just messaging each other, like, I feel like a 12-year-old who just found porn, you know, like, I'm just like, oh my God, I can make anything. I can make anything. Like, and you know, I'm always just endlessly full of ideas about things I want to do. And now I just feel like I have the tools for that, which is amazing.
I would agree with that. I would say that AI, that vibe coding, is fulfilling the promise that was like, that was computers in the 80s and 90s when they were like, they'll make your life better and everything can be automated.
Right.
And you'll be able to have software to do everything you want. And it turns out like, no, that was, everybody just built all their applications in Excel because that was like the thing people could figure out, right? Side note, I once got in a fight with an engineer, not like a fist fight, but like a technical fight with an engineer at NASA, because he was my mentor when I first started there. And then one day, like, he was using this very old piece of software from Fortran, and I had upgraded to this new piece of software. And one day he came into my office and he was like, can you teach me how to use the new software? I have to admit, I've been trying to build jet engine modeling software in Excel for the last 6 months and it's not working. And I was like, yeah, it's not going to work. And he was like, oh, I know that now. But that was the moment. That was the moment when I knew. Anyway, so vibe coding has fulfilled the promise. I'll tell you what freaks me out, though. What keeps me awake at night, besides the like rampant security flaws and all these applications everybody's writing, is that to this day, as far as I know, like for every dollar you spend vibe coding, like I think they're spending like $5 to $15.
Right.
To like afford. Right. And I'm like, oh, they're either going to make this cheaper or they're going to start turning the crank on that price real soon. And that freaks me out a little bit because I can't imagine going back. The pace at which I can write software is insane. My ability to like, and even just to be a good, like it used to be like very, I'd be very hesitant to like go refactor code. I'd be like, I know I need to clean this up, but it's just time to make progress. And now it's like, no, like refactor this for me, please go. I'm going to go for my
parallel, you know?
Yeah.
Right.
And so I have trouble imagining going back, but I'm afraid of how much it's going to cost soon.
Likewise. I want to ask like a really sort of naive question. I know the answer to inherently, but like having only coded in this paradigm, other than G code, I could write manual G code prior to this, but like I am a little bit shocked at how it worked. I don't understand how it worked. Like, are you a real software engineer? Are you typing out your entire code base, or were there tools prior to this that helped you pull things together in terms of like libraries, or like are you copying and pasting bits and pieces from places and then cleaning it up, or like how the hell did that work?
A little bit of both. Yeah. Yes, we were manually typing out the whole code base, except software developers are the laziest people you can ever imagine, and so they're very, very good at making like reusable libraries.
Mm-hmm.
And so like any code on the web, like 80% of it is reused libraries that I don't look at. I just import Next.js or Node or React, and I'm relying on that. Mm-hmm. And then on top of those foundations, and like you've probably seen, I'm guessing you guys have seen like npm install fly past the screen.
Yeah.
So that's for Node Package Manager. So people, there's this whole ecosystem of just free and open source packages that are available. And your whole app is built on top of them. And then your 10,000 lines of code sit on top of that. And yes, like up until a year ago, like humans wrote almost all of that code. There's like IDEs and stuff that could help like template some of that and things like that. But for the most part, and so the reason software engineers are like that is because they jump around from job to job to job and they want to take their code with them. So they publish a lot of open source stuff. Yeah.
Nice.
Right.
Yeah.
That exact thing
shocked me working with the guys working with when I started Airshop about how much code like I ended up almost all of it got refactored into something else and we restarted kind of in a totally different way. But like, I was just shocked to be like 15,000 lines. It was a crazy amount, pages and pages and pages. And I would just be like, doing this by hand? Like, I don't understand. Like, that is so much to type out. And seems to be a lot of carpal tunnel out there, I guess.
I wish that the machining, and like one of the reasons I want GitHub to be a skill that machinists learn is that like we could share macros. And like the closest thing we come is that like everybody uses the Renishaw or the Bloom macros for the most part. And so we all just use these and take for granted that there's a few thousand lines of G code that we all just run. And that's not exactly true. Like Renishaw has this macro generator that like they have abstract definitions of the macros and then they get customized for every machine and everything. Bloom does the same thing. But like, how many of us write the same freaking probing macros and stuff? And so, like, as a community, I feel like we could do a lot more, like, in-process inspection and things like that. But the challenge is that, like, there's a skill set in using Git and GitHub that's, like, not part of the community, which hopefully will be soon, where that could be, like, brought into place. And I think the place where it might actually have a chance is in Fusion add-ins. I think the Fusion community out there, like, I'm hoping, like, I know people are starting to write their own productivity add-ins. I know three people who wrote an add-in to like ask you to auto rename your toolpaths when you create them. So as soon as you hit okay, it like pops up a little window and says, give this thing a name. Yeah. So hopefully we can start to publish those things open source and converge on like, okay, Autodesk, if you won't do it, we will and share those.
Yeah, that's a great point.
Interesting. Do you let your Fusion posts auto update?
No, never. Ooh, no.
I didn't think so. I just had to ask.
No, but I also have like, I usually tend to have like pretty hacked posts and stuff. So like I'm pretty like, I mess with my posts way too often. I've smashed two probes messing with my posts. So
I suppose, yeah, that was my next question. Like watching Justin's face as he described that makes me think of all the, like the times when I've mentioned, you know, the fact that we're vibe coding G code tools here that post straight to the machine with no human intervention, and Justin's kind of like clenching in his seat, like I would never send that to my machine. Like sharing all this.
I would if I had tests. If I had tests that validated the G code that was being know? I've actually thought about vibe coding.
Warning. I was like, I think that's going to come.
Yeah. I've actually thought about vibe coding like a machine simulator. I'd like to do it so that you could imagine like vibe coding G code and then running it through like something that's simulated to your control. Fanuc will sell you one for like, I don't know, $5,000 or something. But like, we need this. We need it. Like the machine vendors should put them out there, please. And if they don't, maybe I'll vibe code them. But imagine, I mean, it's one thing to have like, you know, Fusion sim to make sure your part comes good, but like, wouldn't it be great just to know if the G code's going to error on the machine or not when you're developing a post? Like, is this going to post or not? And is this going to run or not? That would be amazing. And that's a great place for open source tools. If I ever get the chance to like bend the ear of a machine vendor, I'm going to be like, do this. You need to put out a simulator for free on the internet so that people can write vibe code against your simulator and have like a testing environment. That is the one thing like, and people take it for granted. I was working with a shop on an ERP and we were integrating Stripe. I was like, and QuickBooks. And I was like, well, let's fire up their sandboxes. And he was like, what's a sandbox? And I'm like, well, they like all these companies will give you a testing environment so that you don't have to like live process credit card transactions. And he was like, really? That would be, I'm like, how else could you like build software and know if it's working? You're not going to like process transactions. Right. And he goes, oh, that makes a lot of sense. But like as a machinist, you're used to just like, well, let me put this G code on this machine and see if it works. And I'll stand there watching the machine, Yeah.
Yeah.
But like software developers have like refused to work that way. So your CI pipeline, your continuous integration pipeline, your GitHub automated tests, they run a full simulated version of your website. They can even have like little browsers. You probably saw, if you use the VibeKit, these E2E tests it suggested, which stands for end-to-end. It's got like a little simulated browser and it's like, not exactly this, but close enough, like loading your site and clicking on a button and making sure a certain call gets made and looking at a copy of your database to make sure the data, like the machining world needs to have that. That it has to happen. I just like we as a community, like It was interesting. I was talking at the Toolpath Summit. There was a machine vendor who was like, what has to happen? Or somebody was like, what has to happen for us to do this? And I was like, well, I mean, the machine vendors won't do it until we'll pay for it. So if everybody just refuses to buy machines for like 6 months, then nobody buys a machine, right? It's just, we all just like boycott buying new machines.
Like COVID.
Then they'll say, okay, we'll do it, you know? Yeah, like COVID. But shy of that, like they're just going to keep selling machines. And while they're selling them, they're not going to add these tools. So I don't know what drives it, to be honest with you, but I wish that some sort of a, you know, like a FANUC simulator or a Haas simulator existed that you could test software against. And they definitely exist. Like the companies have them. I just don't think they want to give them out.
Yeah. Like I've been thinking about doing that for my ABB robots. You know, because I am like vibe coding a fair, not from scratch, but like I'm taking it's rapid, but like different code sources, pulling them together to make like multi-robot programs. And then there's a few times now over the last year where I've been like, damn, it'd be good to just have a really simple like little web UI simulator of this where I can test whether my old like 20-year-old controllers are going to accept the rapid because they have like bloody syntax errors constantly. And I think last time I tried to vibe code one of those was probably about 6 months ago, and the models were like, not too hard, but I'm probably due. There's a few projects like that. There's like my Kita Parts Builders. Like I tried it 1 year, like, nah. Tried it 6 months later, nah. And then suddenly, you know, a year ago, I was like, woohoo, we're green. Go. Can do it now.
Interesting. Yeah. That's where like an experienced software engineer could give more guidance and it could get it done. Yeah. But like, as the model gets smarter and smarter, you need less software engineer. That's interesting. Yeah.
Right. Have you heard that story of Jim's? It's like one of the coolest stories of like vibe coding that I'm aware of is like he hired this company from Finland, right? Or somewhere where it was like tens of thousands of dollars to make you like a 3D configurator of his product, these shelving systems. And it was okay. It was very costly and continued to be costly on an ongoing basis. And then we were going back and forth chatting and, you know, about, oh, it'd be cool if I could just make your own. And then one, it was like January, you were like rounding to having to pay the subscription again. And you just were like, I just made my own. And I was like, that's crazy. And it's 2D, but it's like in almost every way better because it was super slow too, the 3D version. And you send a lot of work through it, send a lot of customers to go through it, and they can like send him configurations to customize. And it's very,
I think I put
very cool.
About okay through it in the last 15 months or something. Like,
that's amazing.
It's been good. Yeah.
Now that you have the interesting thing would be now that you have like a really dialed 2D version of it to see if you could prompt the AI and be like, this works in 2D. I want to extend it to 3D now because it has like, especially after you've been able to refactor it into something the AI can consume more now with tests and everything, that'll give it enough structure to be able to upgrade it to 3D. That'll be an interesting experiment.
Yeah, it's very close to that point actually, because just in the last few weeks, I've built scripts that take its 2D JSON output and can build it in 3D in Rhino for me, like using my block manager in Rhino. So it's very close to a 3D simulation at least of what you've built in the browser, I think. That's coming.
I heard that you should not let Justin anywhere near your Rhino code because he'll write macros to
filthy macros.
That was back when I was good at Rhino. It's mostly we had this stupid thing where we'd just like create cones all over your project. So I'd be like, literally like cones like attached all over, like, and half the time they would like create so many arrays that they would crash the program, and which was nasty too. But it's like, I made this cool project so you could nest all your files for the laser cutter, and then it would trash your project instead.
My son told me he wanted to be an architect recently, and I have an engineering degree. So I was like, I don't know if that's going to happen, buddy. But one of his friends, both their parents are architects. So I was like, you can go talk to them. They'll talk you out of it.
Yes,
I was like, just ask him to tell you how much time they had to spend in studio, and then that'll scare you away.
It would just be such a crazy different experience now. I don't even know how to perceive it because there's so much time doing things so trivially that like either you would be expected to do a lot more because like you could just create like sometimes you just present like renderings and line drawings, and now I can just do that and like 13 minutes with AI. So it's like, how do you prove what you're actually coming up with versus what's, and is it just as viable that you've, I don't know, I haven't had these discussions with anybody lately, but I've thought about it a lot of like, so much of it was like, what's the style of the image you created and how did you do it? And what is the feeling of it? And it's just so attainable.
I mean, that's happening everywhere. That's happening in software engineering and physical engineering. People talk about the singularity and whether AI is, and I was talking about with a friend, he was like, it's pretty depressing because like all of this knowledge and everything is going to be useless when soon like every 12-year-old is just going to be able to ask AI to do whatever for them. And I can appreciate that perspective, but if you rewind to like the late 1800s when the Industrial Revolution was going on, it's kind of a pretty strong analogy to like all these craftspeople were building nails and hand sawing boards, and like all of a sudden machines were invented and the entire world changed. And yes, obviously like craftsman, blacksmith, nail making isn't a thing anymore. So like you have to get through that transition. But like with all this added capability, we just found more stuff to do and like more busy work. And so like, I don't know, I guess the optimist in me wants to hope that like 30 years from now or 50 years from now, we'll come out the other side of this and like, there'll be more interesting stuff to do. But like, it's not just architecture, like software engineers, like you can fake your way into like a pretty good software engineering result if you know a decent amount about vibe coding. And it's like, you're in this situation where like, maybe twice a month you need to have real software engineering skills to unfuck what the AI really, like whatever corner it backed itself into. But like, it's really hard to like figure out in the moment if somebody has those skills and will they ever even develop those skills? Because whatever they assigned me for homework in undergrad for computer science, like you could speed run an entire computer science degree in a weekend with AI right now and never learn a damn thing. So same kind of thing. Maybe we should all be really afraid to get on bridges and airplanes and skyscrapers for the next 50 years or something.
They were made on Bridge Builder AI.
Yeah.
I remember that game.
We should vibe code one of those again. That was fun.
Yeah, that was fun. I've been hanging out a little bit lately with an investor at one of the like government, like the Australian government's like big investment bodies. Just another dad at school, and it's really interesting talking to him because he's in this world, but from the sort of how fucked are we and how quickly sort of perspective. I won't sort of go into the stuff we've chatted about, but it's been super interesting like having someone on my periphery who's in that side of it.
I wonder about that. Like you look just the, like the raw math, like if the VCs are even using the AI even a little bit to analyze their position, that like the math has to say like one of us is going to be really not fucked and the rest of us are going to lose our shirts, but we're willing to bet like that we're, you know, like there's a limit on the amount of, you know, like anyway, it's pretty interesting though. Right. Cause if you think, you know, there's a lot of like private equity roll-ups going on and everything right now. And I had a moment to think about this on a plane the other day. And I was like, what, like the reason that was happening is that they ran out of innovative high growth things to invest in. Like we kind of plateaued technologically. And so like if there's something that has huge growth potential, then all these rich people will put their money in that and that's what they'll bet on. And when like those opportunities in like the late, you know, 2010s started like leveling out, then they start going like, okay, how much can we extract? Like what can we roll up and extract more juice out of the existing economy? And so now like maybe the AI has given them like a new target to put like high growth stuff in and we'll see less of this roll up stuff. I don't know. It's my hypothesis anyway, but I'm hopeful that it's like, for me, I'm trying to be hopeful that it's like going to unlock the next S curve for us as a society. I think it has potential to do that if we can avoid it, like launching all the nukes in a full Skynet on us or something.
Yeah. I'm kind of with you. I'm in the optimistic boat as well, but yeah, it'll be interesting.
I get family that asks me about it a lot because they know I'm always making something or playing with something. And there is this contradiction that I have possessed of being somebody that generally talks and cares quite a bit about like environmental things, you know, caution about using environment resources and stuff. But yet I'm fully into this like vibe coding world that seems to be purported to be incredibly wasteful. it's a defensive stance, but my defensive stance is optimistic in that I believe we will, with so many people thinking and trying and making this stuff, it has to get more efficient or otherwise it just stops. Like, nobody's going to keep funding this. And these giant corporations that are funding it also aren't going to keep funding it if they don't find a way to make money. But you go back to like how Amazon was like, you know, negative, turn the switch finally. And now they're just like, you know, constantly raking in money. There's got to be some corollary to like, somebody's going to figure out how to like do the Pied Piper, like middle out algorithm that suddenly everything is half is, you know, half as hard to mine the Bitcoin, you know? That's my theory, my hope. I don't have any solid science behind any of it, but.
All right. I'll wait for the secondhand GPUs. Thanks. Send me a few.
That's right.
That's the same thing with hard drives right now.
Do you know the history? I can give you a brief history of how we got here. It's pretty interesting. I think it was 2012. Somebody at Google published a research paper on this transformer architecture that kind of unlocked the whole like modern LLM thing. And then somebody else, like when I was in school, they would always teach you like, keep your neural net as small as possible. If you make it too big, it'll like overfit. I mean, overfitting just means like it'll predict the data you trained on really, 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 really well. But if you ask it something outside the training set, it'll give you garbage. It was like pretty provable for a long time that if you made your neural net too big, it would overtrain, it would overfit. And so you wanted to keep the neural net small. But then they came out with this transformer architecture. And one day somebody was just like, I wonder what happens if we make it bigger. Like, I know the math and the logic and the wisdom says it'll overfit, but it didn't. They made it bigger and it got better. And they were like, whoa. And then they made it bigger again and it got a lot better. And then they made it like as big as like the biggest supercomputer. Somebody was like, well, shit, just keep going. Right? So they made it like as big as the biggest supercomputer could make it. And it kept getting like a lot better. And all of a sudden it got like, it started having conversations. It became like very useful all of a sudden. People were like, whoa. And so that was the moment where people were like, build bigger data centers, must get it bigger. And so that's like GPT-2, GPT-3. And then the jump from 3 to 4 was like, they had to construct like bigger supercomputers. And we're starting now to see it leveling off again. The scary thing is they're like, the math says, like, we don't know why it's getting better. We don't understand what's going on. We just know that if we make it bigger, it gets better. So we just have to keep making it more bigger until it stops getting better. And they're starting to see signs of like it leveling off, that it's like you can make it bigger and it won't continue to get better. I'm oversimplifying things a little bit, but it's like first order correct here. But that's like all of this money is going into, because they're like, well, we don't know how big of a computer we should make. And they're like, well, so just make the biggest one you can possibly make. Is big. And they're like, how big? And they're literally like, buy as many chips as you can buy. That's it. And we just keep going until we find a limit. We don't know where the limit is. So it's kind of like a modern day Manhattan Project in that sense, which is very interesting. Yeah.
Right. Crazy.
Amazing.
And and like planning their own like nuclear plants to power them, because the jurisdictions don't have enough power to support them. And
powers are a real problem.
Water use is maybe the craziest part to me. Do you understand the water use thing?
It's basically cooling. They need cooling, yeah. And then the other problem is that the other reason they have a lot of water use is that they literally can't get enough power for these data centers. They're very power hungry. So they end up like putting giant fields of generators outside the data centers. And so they need a lot of water to like cool these like generators and stuff. They make a lot of pollution, but it's literally cooling. Yeah. These things are just producing crap tons of heat. So it's like using a lot of water, but that it's like using the water and then putting it back in, but just hotter, but like also more polluted and stuff. Right. So, it's not like the water is going away. It gets put back into the source, but it's being used for cooling.
Yeah.
Also that I can look up, what do I do when a pee goes in my toddler's nose, and how to solve that?
Latest
problem.
You definitely do whatever the AI says in that situation. It's 100% right.
Its first take was it heard me say PEE, and it's like getting urine in a toddler's nose is common during diaper changes. It's generally not dangerous. And I was like, no, the green like vegetable. I was so confused at first. I was like, urine? What?
That's true. Urine is sterile. Yeah. So it's fine other than the smell.
I've been fine with that. That's fine. Yeah.
So did you like get out the tweezers?
We had tweezers. My wife was in the shower when this happened. I was finishing food, dinner, and I came upstairs kind of like, I'm going to need some help, because he's like, Dad, look, I put a pee in my nose. Yeah. And then now that I'm looking at these options, Erin immediately got it out with some tweezers once she got out, and, you know, I just was kind of holding him down. But there's so many options, apparently, of how to do it. And it seems so like she said at first, it disappeared up there. And I was like, where up there? Like, how far does a pee go? You know?
Did you get it into your mouth?
Just looking at
Did you get it
like,
that far?
You haven't dealt with this?
No, Jim, you have three kids? He's dealt with this for sure. Every kid shoves something up their nose, yeah. Or swallows a coin.
I don't know that I have, honestly.
There's probably a spider for that there that goes up your nose.
Spider, yeah. We have that special spider.
Well, you can really blow lightly on the other nostril and it will pop out too. We didn't try that, but that sounds more fun.
I like that you had to go ask for help and your wife was probably like, all right, I'll help you figure this out.
I had found all the tools and I was like, I got a headlamp. And then she just comes in without any of those things, grabs the tweezers and pulls it out. And I was like, I didn't even use my headlamp. You know, like, I was going to see up there.
That's the moment I would have gotten in big trouble, because I would have been like, this is awesome. Let's go to the shop and I'm going to use the Freddy. And Jaron would have been like, this is not funny. And I would have been like, I'm not joking.
Really high suction. Can you turn that down?
Yeah. Like, this is definitely going to work.
I mean, I'm pretty sure they can suck your brain out in the funeral home through your nose. So,
really?
Yeah. Be careful with that, kids.
So, yeah.
I'll have to ask Simon if anybody's ever cleared out a nose with a Freddy. Maybe
funeral.
I'll be the first. Yeah.
He doesn't take those ones back for refurb.
Oh, God. I bet he would.
On that fun note,
I bet he would.
I think we need to go, because I think I've got some people that need back in the office, but it was great having you. I'll do the
thing.
Where can we find all of your things? And we're going to put a link to your Vibe Code kit in our show notes for sure, but where should people find you?
JustinGrayLabs.com, G-R-A-Y, JustinGrayLabs.com.
Justin Gray.
Thanks, guys.
I like it.
Thanks so much for having us. Thanks so much for coming on. It's awesome.
I'm pretty active on Instagram. Yeah. Justin Gray Labs on Instagram too. Yeah. Yeah. Yep.
Check it out.
Yeah. That's where I post all my content about replacing office chair wheels with rollerblades. That's what I do on Instagram. Yeah.
And fighting off the pie chart attacks.
The pie charts. Yeah. Yeah. That started out as a joke. It's becoming less of a joke. Sometime soon, you all are going to get a lecture on the evils of pie charts. Let me tell you.
didn't you get like a Trojan? Did your kid print one off and bring one into your space?
Oh, it's even worse than that. I mean, I've gotten so many, like, here, Dylan, like, overnighted me a pie chart that he machined me one time. He was like, what's your address? I'm gonna send you something. And then the next day this shows up. And Easton from Moria Manufacturing sent me some like steel drops I was using in those fidget pistons. And I open up the box and there's a pie chart in there with like a made up pie chart that he used AI for. And I thought I had thrown it out. And then like, I was cleaning up my office one day and I asked my son to like throw some cardboard out in the recycling. And in that pile of recycling was the pie chart. So he like went and found it and like brought it into my office. Yeah.
I see.
And then
I thought somebody
the worst part
told him to print it and bring it to you.
The worst part was he brought it in and he was like, Dad, we found a use for a pie chart in school. And I was like, yeah, whatever. You're just messing with me. But he was like, no, you can use it. You can like put a little arrow on it and use it as like a spinner to test probabilities. And I was like, oh, crap. Like, that's like the one actually valid use for a pie chart. This sucks. Like, I have to admit that there is now, because I used to say there's no reason to ever make a pie chart. Now there's one reason, one and only one. So, yeah, he got me pretty good there.
Amazing. Oh, yeah. Thanks, Justin.
Thank
you. Really appreciate you coming on, taking the time. It's awesome to speak to a real software engineer, get an insight into your world.
Let's take a look at the security on your ERP, Jim. Let's scan that, okay?
Okay. I'm a little afraid to have you look at AirShop, but it's coming. Feels good. Feels good right now, but do another few AI reviews first.
Cool game.
Right. Well, have a good night. evening, day, Jim.
Will do. Catch you later.
Bye, guys.
Yeah. Bye, Justin. Bye, Justin.
Bye.
He said he had to push some things before he came to bed. I heard him in the study, all those words left unsaid. He's been working on a branch that I don't have access to. And he's been making little changes, testing something new. He used to only pull for me, I was his origin. Now he's fetching from a remote I've never heard of, darling. And I found it in his history, he thought he'd cleared the law. He's been cloning something secret while I'm walking the dog. He said it's nothing, said it's just a side project, honey. Said he never shipped a prod without me knowing. But I've seen the timestamps, baby, and it ain't funny. Something's building in the dark and it keeps growing. Did you send him a pull request? Did he merge you without review? Was it late when he approved it? Did he pass your little test? Is that why he never sleeps? Is that because of you? He used to commit to me. Oh, he used to commit to me. Now he's pushing after midnight to somebody's repository. He used to commit to me. I found a conflict in the bed sheets, diff I can't explain. He said he'd done a rollback, but the change and just still remain. He's been stashing little secrets in a place I cannot see. Said he's just refactoring, honey, that don't land with me. She must have opened up an issue, and he jumped right on the thread. Assigned himself immediately, left me here instead. And I know she's made a fork of something that belonged to us. Now he's merging in her features without even making a fuss. He said it's just a dependency, it doesn't mean a thing. Said every developer needs something running on the side. But a man don't set his status to available in spring unless he's got a deployment that he's trying hard to hide. Did you send him a pull request? Did he merge you without review? Was it late when he approved it? Did he pass your little test? Is that why he never sleeps? Is that because of you? He used to commit to me. Oh, he used to commit to me. Now he's pushing after midnight to somebody's repository. He used to commit to me. I am not a legacy system. I'm not something you deprecate and leave. I have been his main branch from the beginning, and I will not be the one orphan in the end. Don't you push to her. Don't you push to her at night. Come back to origin. Come back and do this right. He came home and said he'd done a hot fix, looked me in the eye. Said the whole thing was a runtime error, gave a little sigh. Said he never meant to ship it, said he'd roll it back for good. Said he loved me like a local server, baby, knock on wood. I said, honey, I've been patient, I have read between your lines. But a woman knows a merge commit when she sees the signs. So you better push a message that makes sense to me tonight. 'Cause I'm about to raise an issue when I'm ready for a fight. did you send him a pull request? Did he merge you without review? Baby, I'm his main. I'm not a branch that gets suppressed. And he's gonna have to choose between the old code and the new.